What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the Art of Suffering podcast with Dalton Darnell. Today we have Gabe Castro, and I don't know Gabe from Adam. I'm meeting him for the first time today, so we're going to kind of jump into his story and kind of listen to his testimony a little bit, what he's got going on and where he's headed. So, Gabe, thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to meet you, sir.
Hey, you bet, man. So kind of let's get started kind of where you live now and what do you do for a living?
I live in California. Mm-hmm. I'm in the southern San Joaquin Valley in Bakersfield.
Okay.
Right at the foothills of the Sierras there.
Okay, cool. And what do you do for a living down there?
I am a construction foreman for a grading company. The majority of what we do is we build cells for landfills. So the big pit where they put the trash, we just come in with either excavators and rock trucks or scrapers and do whatever we have to do to build their design for their system, their containment system.
Now, how long have you been doing that?
I've been doing this particular bit for about 2 years, but I started running equipment on a feedlot, just loading feed trucks with a loader, cleaning out pens and stuff like that. And I just figured I had a knack for equipment and just always kind of liked it. And then probably about 2003, so about 22 years now I've been running equipment.
Man, that's a long time, man.
That's a long time.
Well, you must have liked something about it if you've done it for that long. Does it pay pretty good?
It does now. But I, you know what? I was probably about 20 years old, and this old cowboy was on our way to go brand some calves. And we stopped at the store to get some water and Gatorade and whatnot. He said, why you want to be a cowboy? I said, man, I love it. It's in me. He said, you're too smart. He said, you need to go do something else with yourself. He said, being a cowboy is the most over-glorified and underpaid job there is. And I thought about it for a second.
I agree.
I was offended, to be honest with you, you know, because, I was trying to earn that title, you know, a cowboy. But so I kind of always stuck with me, and I come up with this kind of half-cocked plan. I was like, well, you know, I'll just day work and then try to work my way into a spot where I can have my own small little herd. And that's kind of what I did. So I wound up getting into the oil fields down here because there's a lot of oil down here. And I got into oil, you know, to work to try to build a cattle habit. That never happened, but.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of the deal, man, is like, it's no different than UFC fighters or anything else. If the guy making the money recognizes that you'll do it for cheaper because you love it, they're going to take advantage of that. That's just how the world works. And so mm-hmm. I've had, you know, MMA fighters on here that are like, that's exactly how fighting is. Like, you're going to fight anyway. They fight the guy at Walmart for free just because they love to beat people up, you know? And it's interesting to me. And I asked the question because you find somebody doing, you know, that's been doing something for that many years. And I posted on Facebook not long ago that I was needing to hire help in the rope shop. And I start everybody out at $10 an hour. And everybody in the comments was like, you can't live on $10 an hour. You can't live on $10 an hour, yada, 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 which is true. But the fact remains that you have no skills. Why would I pay you if you have no skills? Like, what? So I'm supposed to bring you in for a lot of money when you can't tie a rope? You can't do anything? You know, what the heck?
I think I day work a good 3-4 years. Before I ever even saw a check, you know, I mean, you know how it goes, you know, bouncing around ranches around here, you know, buddies, hey, we need a hand. You come work. The boss barely talked to you, you know, and you're working for free. But I mean, I didn't care. Like I said, I loved it, but
yeah,
they wanted to see what you were about before they even thought about paying you.
No, 100%. And that's it's part of being young, man. It's part of knowing nothing. And that's where, like, I don't know if it's because of the internet or whatever. And my son's big thing right now is, Dad, am I smarter than you? Dad, am I stronger than you? Dad, am I? And I always tell him, you're six smart and I'm 33 smart. You're six strong and I'm 33 strong. Meaning I've been on the planet for 33 years. So, like, it's not going to measure up yet. You got to keep working after it. And that's not to say that there aren't people younger than me, smarter than me. But the fact of the matter is that if you're going into the workforce and you, quite frankly, have zero skills that can benefit the person hiring you, your approach to this situation should be one position, and that is hat in hand. Mm-hmm. Hey, I need a job, and I need somebody to teach me how to know how to do something. And that's it. And you did that. You know what I mean? It's like you said, it pays good now. Well, yeah, you've been doing it for 23 years. You know what I mean? Like, of course it does.
Yeah. No, it's to answer your original question, I think it's the instant gratification of taking a piece of machinery and moving a bunch of dirt all at once. You know, like, you can see your progress within minutes. You know, you make a pass, you back up, you're like, oh man, I just moved all the dirt. You know, I don't know, it's something kind of really fulfilling about it for me. I don't, for whatever. And you know what's weird I've noticed is operators, for the most part, they all, every single one of them, have the same exact personality type. And I'm not exactly sure what it is about a certain kind of person that is drawn to equipment, but they're all the same. All of us, for some reason.
That's what my boss man used to say. He was like, you don't want to be a tractor driver. You want to be a tractor operator. Mm-hmm. I was not. I was terrible. I'm telling you, I'd beat the hell out of a tractor trying to get that list done. I'm whooping and riding across some pastures with freaking round bells, dude, trying to get home before dark. I'm telling you, I was heck on a dang piece of equipment. But you find that often with cowboys. Is cowboys usually aren't the greatest mechanics. They can get it done and get from A to B, but they usually have a little different set of skills. So
usually,
that's funny, man. So you said you got a little herd going now, like you got a little place.
No, sir. No, that was the goal, but that didn't happen.
That never happened. I can totally understand that.
You know what? I was working for this outfit, and this old man told me he was the owner. He said, and he's got a pretty big place. It's like, well, California big, I guess. It's, I think, just north of 10,000. And he said, you know how to make a small fortune in cattle? I said, no, how? He said, start with a big one. I went, oh, man, that's not a good sign.
No, but it's true. I mean, dang it, man. The only guys that I know of that make money are the yearling guys. Mm-hmm. Like, the yearling deal makes money. If you got land, you can make money. And I'm sure, you know, feeding them, feedlots do well, too, but there's little pockets of guys who've got it figured out and do a good job. And then most everybody's got a tax write-off is what they're hunting. Which stinks, but I mean, it's how it is, man. I mean, what are you supposed to do? It's like, it's the best tax write-off in America. So buy freaking 50 head and stick them out there in your yard. And now everything's a deduction, you know? So
yeah,
I got big hopes for trying to get some ground down here to run yearlings on, and hopefully we'll see. God's doing a lot in my life, and none of it has anything to do with cowboying. It all has to do with people and his kingdom. So that's what we're focusing on right now.
Where's down here, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm in Alabama.
Okay.
Yeah, central Alabama, dude, sweating it out. We're originally from here. We moved the company to Oklahoma probably, I guess it'd be about 5 years ago now. And we lived there for four years, and then we moved the company back in January of this year. So, and it's all online sales, so it doesn't matter. You know, we can ship to anywhere, but it's an okay place to live if you don't mind sweating. But my family's from here. My wife's family lives here, so we got a lot of help with the kids and stuff, and so she's into that. But hey, if you don't mind me asking, so is Castro? So you Mexican or?
So I'm half native. I'm half native and half Hispanic.
Holy crap, dude! Are you like the greatest roper that's ever walked the face of the planet?
No, not even close.
The Indians, dude. The Indians and the Mexican guys I've worked with are, it's like a different sport. Do you hear me? Like me as a red bearded white dude will never have the same abilities. I'll tell you this. I've gone to goat ropings. You know what a goat roping is?
Mm-hmm.
They make the Indian kids rope with a pigging string and they still beat the crap out of you. They're healing with a pigging string and they're like, woo! I mean, it is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And I've been telling myself for about 3 years, I'm like, I have to learn Spanish. And bucket list, I got to go rope with charros in Mexico. Like, I just to be around them and watch what they do, man, is it's just nuts what those guys can do with a rope. And I'm like, I'm pretty handy with a rope. Like, I can rope, you know? But nothing compared to, it's just the culture, I guess. It's what those guys do, you know?
Well, where we're at, there's such a huge, such a huge Spanish influence. The Buckaroos and the Californios, they're real big over, well, not so much anymore, but, you know, when I was a kid growing up, dude, big conchos, you know, big associated saddles, taps, all that. And, dude, I remember that I knew this kid, Bear Ryan. Bear. He was braiding Riata at, I don't know, 10 years old, braiding himself a rope, like an 80-foot Riata. Yeah. We walked out to his dad's little shop, and he's back there just braiding rope. But I've been to – so a buddy of mine, we went to go sell some horses or drop off some horses that he sold. And is that this Mexican guy's place. And him and his buddies, they were just running these two-year-old colts down this alleyway and – grabbing the hind foot as they're running by, and they would dally off on the big Mexican saddle horns. They would dally off on the big long Riatas, dude. I mean, and just smoking rope as they're running down this. And I was like, what in the world are they doing? In my mind, I'm like, that's a wreck waiting to happen. But I mean, dude, like as fast as these things could run on by, they would just flick it out there, bam, land a foot, dally off. And I was like, holy crap.
Dude, it's crazy. So like a big part of what we do selling the ropes is educating people on the ropes. Like that is probably 90% of my job in marketing is to teach people the differences on the ropes. Well, we sell a wax cotton and all of our cottons come out of Mexico. They come dry. Then we wax them and stretch them and really break them in for people. And it still takes a lot of breaking in even after I send you the rope. Like you still got to stretch it and use it and heat it up and all the things. And I was at this daggum clinic, dude. I had taught a clinic, and they had a roping, and we were selling ropes at the roping. And we had wax cottons there. And the lady is a white lady, but she's married to this guy named Pedro Torres. And he's got like a big charro family. They have one of those big cinder block arenas, and they do the horse ropings and the leap of death. They do all that stuff. And one of his brothers walked over to the rope table and picked up a brand spanking new cotton. Okay. Never been stretched, never been used. And anybody that's broken in a cotton, they're freaking kinky. Like they're hard to use. Bro dog shakes a loop out and goes to freaking trick roping with this thing. And I was like, what in the hell? He was like, man, I really like this rope, man. I was like, dude, what in the world? Like, there isn't a white dude on earth that could pick that rope up and do that. And I was like, and Pedro was just like, it's what we do, man. Like, from the time we can walk, like, well, they're walking around with a little piece of twine just doing that stuff. And it literally, I mean, it took me freaking 3 years to learn how to do a butterfly. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
These do what? You want to go fishing? Okay, we'll go after my podcast. You want to see? Come here.
Got to go catch some bluegill.
Yes, right. Say hello.
Hello.
Good morning, sir.
So, yeah, that's funny, man. Like, it's just that culture is really cool to me just because It's like the cowboy world is like 15 years behind the rest of the world. And then like the charro world or the Mexican influence of cowboys from down there is like 30 years behind that. Like they're mm-hmm. just like, that is what those guys do. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. whereas, you know, we treat it like a hobby, or a lot of people do. Not the working guys, but you get what I'm saying. Like a lot of people just wrote for fun. And it's just really neat to me that I would love so much to go to. I got to learn Spanish first. And it's crazy the amount of Spanish speaking people, which I think, what do they speak in Brazil? Portuguese, maybe?
Yeah.
Like Brazilians, Mexicans, they're like, I probably have more followers from those two countries, or at least as many as I do in America.
Really?
That's what those guys do, man. I bet like 60% of my comments are in Spanish or Portuguese.
Really?
Yep. It's crazy.
I bet them Brazilian cowboys down there, they probably don't play, huh?
No.
Going off of their bull riders, they're serious about it.
Yeah, those guys are, that's what they do, 100%.
You know, I hope this isn't offensive, but I was kind of surprised to learn that you guys were from the South with the style of roping you, because I just assumed everybody down that way was kind of like Texas, where they tie off hard and fast, you know what I mean? But you guys are all about that big loop mm-hmm. buckaroo style roping. I like it.
Yeah, so they are. So traditionally speaking, you're going to find about 5 to 7 guys in the entire state of Alabama that pack a 60. And it's one of those things. My dad, you know, 20 years ago or so, saw a video. It was the, it was the Martin Black video. It was an instructional video of them branding. And he's talking about all the different loops and stuff. And so dad just took that video and applied it to Dr. Nearland's. Was like, okay, we can use a hula hand. We can use a backhand or whatever. And then swapped to a Wade saddle. And it's just easier on the calf. There's no argument, in my opinion. There's no argument. I don't care what anybody uses to rope with, just like I don't care what kind of bit anybody uses. It doesn't bother me either way. But if you're asking me to go Dr. Yearland, I'm picking up a 60-foot rope because I want options. No question. And that's the thing is, you know, lots of punchers or whatever will talk smack about not being committed, or you got a slow horse or whatever. There's not a handy guy I've met on earth that couldn't get to the horn with a 30-foot rope. That's not what it's about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just about having the versatility of more weapon, you know? And so it's funny, like I made a Del Viento video years ago on how to throw a Del Viento. And the month that I published that video, my dad went to a trade show in Colorado to find products for 310. And he met Jeremiah Watt. And he told Jeremiah Watt, he was like, man, my son just posted a video on how to throw a Del. And Jeremiah Watt was like, I didn't know anybody in Alabama could even say the word Del Viento. You know what I mean? I was like, it's pretty legit, though. Like, they don't, you know?
That's funny.
It is funny. So we don't get a lot of foot traffic here. Like, there's not a lot of people shopping in store down here. In Wyoming, we did. When we had it in Wyoming, people would come in and stuff. But it is what it is. I actually got a clinic coming up this fall at a cowboy church here in Alabama, where there's some guys, there's kind of like a little pocket of them up there trying to get into it. But yeah, man, it's kind of like an island. There's islands all over the place, you know, California, Idaho, Nevada would be the big island, but then there's little satellites all over the country where these guys are kind of getting it figured out a little bit.
Now, dude, out here, if you tie off, you wind up killing you and your horse, probably. I mean, take off hauling down a mountain or something. Like, you got to be able to burn some slack.
Yeah.
Keep yourself safe. It gets rough out here. It's steep. There's some steep country up here. You ever cowboyed out this way?
No, I've never been to California. The furthest west I've, like, signed on and actually worked was Wyoming. I've done some stuff in Nevada, but it wasn't, it was like big loop ropings and stuff. It wasn't working. I've always wanted to, just haven't really had the time or the opportunity. That's a long way for us, man. Like,
that's a long way.
California is out there.
Yep. Yep. It's dude, it's sad. It's all, a lot of it's going away. You got the big Tejon Ranch. Oh, I say big, but Tejon Ranch, it's, I don't know, 700 something thousand acres. It's right at the base of the Grapevine. The Grapevine is at the very bottom of the San Joaquin Valley. It's what separates like LA and Southern California from the valley. That's the pass that goes up and over. And the Tejon Ranch, it starts at like just east of that center line. It wraps around the east side into the Sierras. It's a gorgeous ranch, dude, but they're starting to sell off and build houses and what the heck are them things? Strip malls and outlet malls, and it's a lot of the land is going away. It's heartbreaking because we used to have so much of it, so many big ranches. And the last big ranch that I worked on, they got sold off to a conservatory. They still run cows there, but you know, nobody owns it anymore. It's not really cowboyed much anymore.
Yeah, it's tough because, like, see, down here, man, everybody's, you know, got 20, 30, 50 head on little bitty spots. But, like, you can run 10 head an acre here, you know.
Daggum.
Yeah, it's a greenhouse, dude. It just grows grass all year long. So, in the yearling world, now, a cow-calf, it might be, you know, two cows and calves per acre. But on the yearling deal, preconditioning anyway, you can load them up.
Yeah.
And out there, it's not like that. But, and then California in and of itself seems like it's that high desert stuff. You know what I mean? You got to have a lot of ground to do it. So
there's a lot of grass out here that just gets so daggum hot that it dies off fast. So a lot of guys, they'll summer in like Oregon where it's still green and lush and full of nutrient, you know what I mean? A lot of guys, well, the way we just do it down here is during the summer, you know, a lot of trace minerals, you know, to supplement and help keep them going through the summer while that grass is, I mean, that grass at that point is just a filler.
Yeah, it's just dead. Standing hay.
Yep. So
are you, Gabe, are you married? You got kids?
I am. I'll be married for 9 years this November. I got two kids.
Okay, cool. How old are your kids?
One will be 21 in October, and the other one's getting ready to turn 8.
Oh, my gosh, bro. You spread them way out. Come on now.
Yeah.
What's okay, so I got a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old. Give me three, okay? Three things to end up with a good 21-year-old. Do you have a good 21-year-old, or are they wild?
My 21-year-old, she's a good kid, but that's by God's grace alone, not because of anything I did.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, I think raising them up in the faith is strong. That's important, especially in this day and age. Let them be sure of who they are in Christ. Their faith, their work ethic, and patience, I would say.
How do you instill work ethic in a kid? This is something I've run into.
Put them to work.
Just put them to work. Don't let them quit.
Yeah, dude. Well, I mean, I tell people, and I don't think they believe me, but I tell them, when I was growing up, so I was raised by my granddad. And dude, he's from the greatest generation. You know what I mean? He started working in a salt mine at like 14 to support his family because his dad died.
Lord have mercy.
And you didn't have an option. He was going to work. You know, I grew up in the country, and there's always chores to do. So whether it's, you know, hoeing weeds or fixing fence or whatever it was, you know, especially when he was home on the weekends, because granddad was a mechanic, you know, he'd wake up. He was up, you know, 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. And then he'd get me up about 6. We'd eat some breakfast and we're going to work, and we'd be outside all day long. And I hated it, man. I hated it. Cause it was always something mundane. Like, give me a diamond hoe and you know, hoe the goat heads or whatever. Go out, kill gophers or, you know, and I hated it. But looking back now, and I tell my 8-year-old, I'm going through it with her right now. She hates it. But I tell her, and I actually explain it to her. I said, look, I said, when you're an adult, you're going to need to know how to work. I said, and for you to be successful, you're going to have to be able to just outwork everybody else. And I said, you can't do that unless you're taught how. I said, and so I'm teaching you how. I just put her to work. You know what I mean? When they want to sit down and fold up on you, just nope, come on, let's go. Let's go to work. I mean, you know, I try to do it as lovingly as possible. It doesn't always go across that way, but that's just what it is. That's, and in my experience, that's the only way to learn work ethic, you know, because it's usually not something we're born with.
No, everybody's like a horse, a natural born skeptic and a cheat. You know what I mean? Like a kid unknowingly, they don't even know what lies are or cheating is, and they freaking do it because, you know, you just want to get off the pressure or get out of work. And like, I got a 6-year old. They come, both of these two come to work with me every day. And, the 6-year old, our deal is we're going to do 20 tie strings with a good attitude, or we're going to do them all. So we can have a crappy attitude. That's okay. But then we're going to do them all. And there's thousands of them. Okay. We're talking, they're hung up there ready to be tied, you know, thousands of them. And so that's the rule. It's like, hey, we can have a you bet attitude and get after it and do 20. And that's all I need for today. Or we can do all of them. And we've had a kind of a mantra all summer long. And I'll ask them the question. I'll say, how do you get what you want? And the answer to the question is hard work and effort. And so we're just in there getting after it. And I'll just say, how do you get what you want? He'll say, hard work and effort. And then I'll say it louder. And then he'll say it louder. And then by the end of it, everybody in the rope shop's looking at me like a lunatic because my 6-year old's like, hard work and effort. I'm like, let's go, dude.
You guys are all fired up. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how else to be because the world's coming. You know, it's coming and it's going to suck for you, buddy. And it's going to be rough. It's going to be. It's a brutal, brutal thing. But I think what you're talking about is the dad's role. I think mama's role is to love on them and be, oh, sweet little baby. And the dad's role is to go, let's go. Let's get after it. You know, and that's what we're supposed to do.
And you make it, you make life a lot easier on yourself, too, if you get mama to realize that. Because I know mine, she's like, aren't you being a little harsh? Nope. Which I gotta be careful because, you know, raised up by my granddad, it was one of those things where you want to cry, I'll give you something to cry. It doesn't matter what you're crying about. You know what I mean? If you cried too much, you're getting another whooping for crying, you know? So, it took a lot of Jesus to undo all that and to be able to be stern, but loving. I struggle with that all the time because there's sometimes where she's like, hey, don't you, this is a little much. I'm like, eh, okay. Yeah. That might be a little bit much, but yeah, no, I 100% agree. That's what it should be right there. We're the get you ready for the world. And they're the ones that the soft place to land when dad's being tough.
No, 100%. And you know, we have a horsemanship principle. It's, kind of steps or phases, I guess. It's air, hair, skin, bone, right? And so when you're teaching a horse something, you always start with air to get the lightest response. And then you quit when you get what you're looking for. So like if I can get him to move his head off of this, then I'll take away the pressure. But if it takes this to get him to move his head, then that's what it takes. And a lot of parents nowadays, you know, they get stuck in offering that correction forever. So it's like, oh, I'm going to be kind. I'm going to be, okay, come on, little Jimmy, you know, okay, hey, come on. And even when they know. And so with a horse, the way you get air all the time to where they move off of air is once they understand, you go from air to bone. Hey, you know I meant move. You know what I mean? And so to me, when my kid's learning something new, we start with, air, hair, skin, bone. Like, if I got to go to a spanking, I'm not scared to go to a spanking. I don't want to. So I'm looking for the response before that. And then once, like him, he's air, hair, skin, bone. My six-year-old, he's air, bone. Like, my biggest thing is a whistle. Yeah. I got my kids on a whistle. I'm talking, they come hauling. And they know if they hear that dadgum whistle to come. And it's super handy, like, anywhere in the public. Because nowadays people are crazy, and if I can't see my youngins, you just can't trust nobody. And so my six-year-old, if he hears a whistle on the TV from across the house, this guy comes, across there. And the reason why is because at about 5 years old, he got the air, right? And if I didn't get the response I was looking for, the bone was coming. Like, I'm hauling A across the playground to grab somebody, you know? And so you have to start giving them the responsibility of reacting to the air. But if the air doesn't mean anything, right? That's how you get the bone, is how you get the air to mean something.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, hey, you better listen the first time I say it, or we're going to have a problem. And that doesn't have to look like an anger thing to me. You know, it can look like, and bone isn't always a butt whooping. It's just a reaction you're looking for. Typically, I'm an arm grabber. Like, I'm not out here in the public snatching my belt off like they did to me when I was a kid. It's like an arm grab. Hey, in a whisper. Mm-hmm. You know, that was terrifying as a kid when your dad whispered at you, you know. But yeah. I just think I've spent a lot of time in the Gospels, like, looking at how Jesus responded to his disciples. And it's really hilarious to me because I'm like Peter. You know, like, I really see a lot of myself in Peter, like how he is real boisterous and just like almost he just ran off at the mouth all the time. And like, it's why I got a podcast, I guess. And and there's one passage in particular. You want to get down? Yeah, we'll go fishing later. There's one passage in particular. Hey, I know you want to go fishing. We got to go later. No, we'll go later. Where Jesus says a parable or explains a parable, and then Peter says, "What? I don't understand. What does that mean?" And Jesus' response to that was like, "Are you listening, dude? What's wrong with you? I already told you what it means." You know what I mean? And so it was this, to me, it's this perfect example of like manly correction. It's like, hey, I'm the rabbi, I'm the teacher. When I'm talking to you, freaking wake up, buddy. Like, listen to me, you know? And that's what I expect out of my kids. If I open my mouth, I want them listening. Like, sometimes it's really important, sometimes it's not. But on the times it is important, like if you're in the road, I need a response time. You know what I mean?
Right now.
And so, yeah, right now. Like, yes, sir. That's what we're looking for, you know? And what's funny, dude, is in today's world, people think that's mean, which is nuts.
Yeah, there's a lot I could probably share on my thoughts on that, but I probably wouldn't. But yeah, man, the world has gone. You know, I keep saying that I think the world's gone sideways, but I think it's always been sideways. It's just, you know, I mean, look at Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
That was pretty out there.
It was, you know, sideways.
It's always been that way. I think it's just, you know, more in your face now. It's just crazy, but yeah.
Exacerbated by the internet, maybe. Like,
oh, goodness.
It's the devil.
The internet is a wonderful and horrible thing all at the same time. There's a, it's been, so finding your content, like your daily devotionals and stuff like that. It's still, you know, it's obviously stuff I connect with, having been in the cowboy world for so long, finding a means to experience Christ through a way that means something to you, that connects. That's really helpful. Cause I mean, if it wasn't for the net, like out here, Dude, all the cowboys I ever ran with, they're rough, you know? There wasn't a whole lot of Jesus in it. And the ones that did, they're long gone now. So being able to find stuff like that to me is a huge blessing. But
No
then all
question.
it could also be really bad.
Hang on just a second. Okay, sorry, Gabe. Dadgummit. That's probably not the last time that's going to happen. Luckily,
It's
I
all
got a
right.
good editor. No, I totally. So you were talking about the good parts of the internet. Like, yeah. So I totally agree with that. And it falls under the category God uses all things for the good, but the weapons to defend against the bad. Is and that's my most fearful part of being a father is like just the terrible shit that can get on your kids if you introduce them to those things too early. And that's the thing about it. I personally believe that like walking with God is one of those things where in the beginning you really need to sit, soak, and learn. And he's preparing you to get up and be able to walk into the world to affect other people. But you have to be pretty daggum bulletproof against sin to be able to do that. You need to be able to sit and have a conversation with a guy about porn or drinking or whatever, and it not allow it to affect you, you know? That's like lifting weights to me. Like you got to practice it. Like God has to change you and harden you to teach you to hate the things, hate the sin, but not the person, not the sinner, you know? That's harder than you think. That's hard to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, dude, because I'm one of them horses that you gotta go straight to bone. You know what I mean? Like you
Yeah.
gotta put on a good set of rock crushers and just stick it to the sides. It's taken some hard lessons for me to get where, and I got a long way to go. Growing up, so like I was saying, I'm half native, half Hispanic, right? So my grandparents are Catholic. My mom, she bailed out when she was 17 or 18, something like that. She had me when she was 19. And then she left my biological father. We moved back to California. I was born in Alamosa, Colorado. We moved back to California, and she was already, just from childhood, some childhood trauma. She was pretty messed up. And so she was a kid trying to raise a kid, and she wound up when I was, shoot, I don't know, I was probably like 6 years old. She wound up really diving into our native side, and we was dancing in powwows and sweat lodge and all that stuff. But my mom, she was always on this journey looking for something, and obviously Christ is what she was looking for, but she was just trying to figure herself out, trying to. She was broken inside. My uncle, her brother, my uncle died when I was probably like 5 years old, and that really messed her up too. And so, I spent a lot of time around, my whole family, the combination. She's a bunch of alcoholics. That's all. Every time we get together, no matter what it was a kid's birthday, drinking, family reunion, lots of drinking.
Totally
You
relate.
know, yeah. Somebody died, drinking. Oh, you got a promotion, drinking. That's what I grew up around, man. And I saw a lot of stuff that, a kid shouldn't have to. And there's a bunch of times I'd wake up, and God, if my mom ever sees this, she'd probably be a little mad, but sorry, Mom, it's part of the story. She, I'd wake up, it'd be middle of the night. Mom left hours ago. I don't know where she went. Didn't know she was okay. This is before cell phones. So you walk out in the living room looking around, don't see nobody. Turn the light on. There she is, passed out on the couch, drunk, naked. And it's like, oh man. Stuff like that, Mom driving drunk, and I reach over and grab the steering wheel because she's about to kill us, and she reached over and smacked the crap out of me. She ever touched my steering wheel? Stuff like that. And so I grew up pretty rough, I grew up really angry. And I think that's what initially drew me to cowboying was it was a means of just getting away. You know, I could just go off and be off in the mountains and just be gone. And then once I really got into it, I realized like I love cowboying. Like I try explaining to my wife. I don't think anybody would understand unless they're actually in it. Like cowboying's not something you do. It's like a part of you.
Yeah.
You know, guys that are really in it, it's just literally who you are. The Lord just created me in a certain way, and that weighs that the cowboy. But
well, you can't do the job without it. It's too hard. It's too like nobody would do it if you just it, like you can't take you can't make a poodle a cow dog.
No.
You can't do it.
No, I don't think any really sane person goes off in the brush with just a horse and a couple dogs, you know, roping Maverick bulls for nothing, you know. You find yourself in a bad spot. You're like, what am I even doing here?
Yes.
But, on a ranch in the mountains, out in the back country, that's where I've always felt the most at peace at home. And so, like I was saying, mom raised us up in the native culture, and so I was exposed to a lot of spirituality. Like I knew there was a creator. I knew it, and I got to experience a lot of really interesting things in the native culture, and it really opened my eyes up to I don't want to say the other side, because that implies something a little nefarious, but it just opened my eyes up to what's really out there as far as spiritually, you know, the word, it's not just us here. Like there's other things out there fighting for our attention. Like there's, I truly believe that there's evil walking this earth every single day, and it's a wolf on the prowl. But anyways, so I always knew there was a creator, but you know, there wasn't ever really a relationship with God or Christ. I didn't really know who he was.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of the way I live my life, in the world, you know, doing worldly things, you know, having kids at 20 years old. And I thought I was a pretty good guy. See, I tried to be a moral person.
Yeah.
You know, skipping over all the hard stuff. I got in 2012, I think it's 2012, I got a DUI. I lost my license. I was a welder at the time. And that was a rough, like, 6 months. Got my license back. Went back to work. Was getting caught up, back up on bills. Everything was going good. And then in 2013, oil completely crashed. And I was in the first wave of layoffs, and I was doing okay. I had enough money saved up for a couple months worth of bills. And then I ran into a buddy of mine. He was at Tractor Supply or something like that, and he was asking me if he was just talking, and I said, you know, I got laid off. He said, I need help at the ranch. You want to come up and work? I was like, shoot, yeah. You know, that's where I'm at home, you know? So I went and worked on this ranch and was living in a wall tent and was happy as could be. And then, I left the ranch. No, it started while I was still working there. I kept my apartment in town, and I would just live on the ranch, you know, during the week. And I'd come back because my brother was living with me at the time. I'd come back and do laundry and whatnot. And I'd never dealt with it before, but I started experiencing some like severe depression. It was really weird because I'd never dealt with it before. And I'd say it was weird because, dude, there was times where I'd be like just looking in the mirror, staring at myself in the eyes, you know, telling myself how worthless I was. You know, you're a piece of this and a piece of that. You ain't this, you know, just all these horrible, nasty things. And then I walk away, what the heck was that? And it happened over and over. And I could feel myself just like It's like a black hole inside me, just sucking me in deeper and deeper. So then I left the ranch, and it got bad. It got real bad. I started drinking a lot because of the depression, and that just made it worse. And then one night, I was staring myself in the mirror, telling me all these horrible things, running myself down. And then next thing I know, I wound up in a almond orchard with my 243 in my mouth, and I took the safety off, put my thumb on the trigger, and that trigger went from about 3 pounds to like 150 pounds. I couldn't pull it. I tried. I couldn't pull it, and I'm just crying. And so I went home, just like trying to analyze what the heck just happened. And then the next day, the day before that, I had talked to my mom on the phone, and I was real short and rude with her. And then that happened. And then the day after that, I called my mom and I apologized. I said, "Hey, I owe you an apology." I said, I was really, really mean. I said, I just been struggling with some stuff. I said, "I don't know what's going on, but I'll get it figured out." And she said, "Are you suicidal?" And I said, I didn't want to answer that question. And
your mom said that?
Yeah.
Golly.
And so Yeah. And so then I thought about it. I didn't want to admit it to her, but then I said, yeah, I am. And at the time, she was at a point in life where she was getting to know Christ. And she was going to this church here in town, and she asked if I would reach out and talk to this certain pastor. And I kind of played it off, and I didn't really want to. And she said, "I want you to promise me you'll talk to this guy." And I said, "Okay, Mom, I promise." And then, so then we hang up, and I put the phone down, and I'm thinking about it, and I'm like, man, this is ridiculous. I don't want to do this. What's that? You know, what's the point? And I had one of those TV moments, you know, okay, God, if you're really there, you know, this guy will get back to me like right now. And so I got on Facebook and messaged this pastor and told him what was going on, and sent the message through my phone on the bed, and it was maybe 3 minutes later, my phone lit up, and I thought, oh man, here we go. Sure enough, it was him. So I thought, okay. Well, I said, you know, if you're there, then he'll get back to me quick, and he did. So then he said he was out of town, but he was having a Wednesday night service and asking if I'd go and meet with him then after service, and kind of, you know, told me how to get a hold of him. And so I went, and I sat in the very back next to the door. I was trying to talk myself out of it the whole time, you know, like, man, I could get out of here. And I didn't. And so I went and talked to him, and he sat me down. And before God even came into the equation, he asked me all kinds of questions about my childhood, and had I experienced any certain traumas, or, you know, like, have you ever been, like, he asked me if I'd ever been abused and molested and stuff like that. And I was like, no. So he asked me all these laundry list of questions. And at the end, he said, man, I don't know. He said, it could be a chemical imbalance, because we're talking about the depression. He said, it could be a chemical imbalance. We can get you hooked up with some doctors. We're going to figure some stuff out. And he said, if you don't mind, you know, can I pray over you? And I said, sure. You know, what's it going to hurt?
Mm-hmm.
So then he asked if he could bring another pastor in, and they both prayed over me, and they did. They laid their hands on me and they prayed, and it was really weird and awkward, especially if you're not used to that kind of thing.
Yes.
So they're praying, and I got one eye open. I'm looking around like, you know, what the heck is going on? And so they're praying hard, and then they end their prayer, and he looks at me, and he's like, how you feeling? I was like, I don't know, the same. He's like, I don't know. I don't know what just happened.
Yeah.
And so he starts telling me these things. He hands me a, he asked me if I had a Bible, and he hands me a Bible. And he said, just for now, he said, read anything in the New Testament. And I said, okay. So he hands me the Bible, and the other pastor, he said, this, you know, Pastor Tom, he'll walk you out. He said, and he's going to stay in touch with you and kind of help you get your feet. And so I'm confused, and we're walking down these hallways, and we walk out these big double doors, and my truck's parked out in this parking lot by itself, and he's telling me stuff. I don't remember what he's telling me. It's kind of going in one ear out the other. And I walk out to my truck, and I fire it up, and I sat down, and I'm thinking, and I was overcome with this just unexplainable sense of joy, and I started smiling. And that confused me even more.
Oh, for
because
sure.
I'm a very analytical person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I analyze and overanalyze just about everything.
Joy's and not I, high up on the priority list.
Exactly. And so, yeah. You know, I'm telling myself, like, depression doesn't just go away like that. That's not the way this works. That's not. And so I'm trying to take it all in, and I'm analyzing everything, and I go home, and I have that Bible, and I throw it on the bed, and I'm just kind of going over the night in my head. And so I pick the Bible up, and I'm just flipping through it, and I flip into, I think it was John. And I used to have the verse memorized, but I don't anymore. But there's a story in John where there was a crippled man trying to make it into this well to get healed,
mm-hmm.
and he can't make it. And so Jesus heals him. And it's like John, like 5:14 or something like that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm reading this little story, and I get to the end where Jesus tells him, he says, "See, you're healed. Stop sinning. Should something worse happen to you?" And man, I mean to tell you, like the second when I read that little line, man, it was almost, I want to say literally, I could hear a voice in my head that wasn't mine. Like somebody was, you know, tapping me on the shoulder. He said, "I'm talking to you." Like, okay. That really freaks me out because, you know, you spend so much time analyzing stuff. You're used to your inner monologue. That wasn't me. You know, he says, "I'm talking to you." And I said, "Okay, here we go." And that's what started me off on this journey. And so then I started keeping a prayer journal, and I started reading, and I spent a lot of time. Well, I was unemployed at the time, so I had all kinds of free time. So I spent a lot of time in the Word and a lot of time praying. And then, man, it was maybe just like 3 weeks later, I met my wife, and she, man, that woman loves Jesus with all her heart.
That's absolutely a game changer.
Man. And there's not a doubt in my mind that I got brought to that point, and the Lord said, "Okay, you're going to need yourself a helper.
Mm-hmm.
Here's this woman for you."
Yeah.
And man, that was huge.
Have y'all seen The Chosen?
Oh, yeah.
Dude, that scene in The Chosen when he heals that dude by the well
mm-hmm.
gave me freaking chill bumps, son.
Yep.
Like the intentionality of it. Like, I don't know if it's like that in the Bible. Like, those guys interpreting the Bible and then showing it in real life is really pretty incredible. But the fact that he was like, "All right, fellas, we're going to town today. We got a fella to see."
Mm-hmm.
And they walk right to that guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're like, "There he is." And he freaking does it, you know? And it was, there's been a lot of moments in that TV show that have been like that for me that I'm like, "Dadgummit, man, that is crazy." Hey, Wiley. Hey, buddy. Go do that in the playroom, okay? Yes, sir. Thank you. But, you know, it's interesting to me, and I get to listen to all these cool stories. And I found this in my own walk with God. It was like you find yourself wandering, like aimlessly almost, where you're just mm-hmm. like, "Okay, I feel like shit and I need help and I don't even know what I need." And then when you tell the story over again from where you are now, it's like this really cool guiding of the path to where you need to end up being. You know what mm-hmm. I'm saying? And even down to meeting your wife. Like, your wife wouldn't have tolerated your old sinful self. If she loves Jesus, she'd have been like, "I don't need none of this." But the fact that you had found the king and that he was changing your heart probably resonated with her in a way that wouldn't have any other way. And what's crazy to me about all these stories is like the fact that your mother, through her own inadequacies or ignorance, whatever you want to call it, as a young person raising a kid, my mom had the same stuff, ends up being the one that sends you to where you found the king. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Which is nuts. Yep. Like, that's crazy. That's crazy to me that sometimes the sources of our trauma end up being this kind of pathway into softening our hearts to what God actually has for us. Because mine's the same way. I mean, my story is similar. Like, the brokenness that ensued from being a kid to divorced young parents ends up turning me into a husband that is hunting God like ferociously to not put my kids in that same position. Like, I literally have a podcast where half of the stuff I talk about is being a husband and being a father and learning from the mistakes of my forefathers, not only my own father, but his father and his father before him, in order to be able to enjoy my children and be able to enjoy my wife the way that God intended that. And everybody else would look at that and you would point the finger at the world would point the finger at the mistakes made by the parents. When in all reality, if you just focus on the things that God made good, God made it good. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Made it good, yeah. Yeah, dude, that wasn't even, that was just the beginning of the story. It's like I told you, you gotta go straight to bone with me, mm-hmm. you know? I thought, okay, I'm saved. Like, we're all good, right? Nope, not even kinda, you know? I just kept trying to figure it out. I just kind of kept doing the same stuff, you know? I wasn't drinking as much, but I was still drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was doing some stuff that I try. There was a lot of brokenness that I didn't even know was there, you know, stuff. And man, don't get me wrong. I'm not blaming anything on my raising and my childhood, but I mean, there's some fact there, you know, that the crap that you go through as a kid, it kind of molds what you're going to be,
mm-hmm.
but what you do with it is up to you. And I never even realized that there's some stuff that I'd buried down inside and it was just rotten down in there. You know, it kept rotting.
Yeah.
I had never dealt with it. And all this stuff was just leading up to me dealing with that stuff to be healthy. But, and in that journey, you know, there's still a lot of drinking and there's a lot of stuff that, you know, just made my wife really sad and mad and bitter. She was expecting me to be this certain husband, and I wasn't that, you know. She was wanting me to be a good husband, a good godly husband, and I wasn't there yet, but she stuck with me. And in all that, that caused a lot of quarreling, and we wound up getting into a really bad spot to where it got to the point where there was like a pivotal moment where we were like, okay, so like, are we still going to do this or are we not? You know, it was a really bad situation. And we chose each other and that right there. So between the time I was saved and between that point right there, there was a lot of stuff that happened leading up to that point. And there's a lot of counseling that the Lord was doing within me. On my heart. Like, I remember this one night, you know, I'm sitting there just like, I'm in the shower and I'm just like, man, why can't I get this right? Like, why am I still doing all the crap that I'm trying not to do? And I had another one of those moments where, you know, God was tapping me on the shoulder and he said, you know, the one thing standing between you and me is your drinking. And I was like, holy smoke. And so that was a huge moment. And building up to this one moment with my wife, when it got to that moment, it just completely wiped the slate clean.
Mm-hmm.
And that from there on, you know, my wife and I, we got into some counseling, marriage counseling, and it just, man, I don't even know how to explain, but the Lord just completely changed me, like overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we had some hard road to come back from some our marital issues, but on that hard road, man, this, I got to a place where I think is where I need to be. And I think as Christians, it's a good place to be, and is where you're living your life every single day, desperately needing Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's not about religion. It's not about the building. It's about a desperate relationship. Lord, I can't do this without you.
Yeah.
Cause I tried. And then when I rely on myself, I screw it up every single mm-hmm. time. You know, I mean, you know, I'm just like a horse, you know, on my own, you know, pretty good at some stuff, pretty handy with some stuff, but mm-hmm. I got to have me with a good rider, man, there's almost nothing I can't do.
Yeah.
You know, and I needed Christ to be that cowboy for me mm-hmm. and to guide me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 100% dependency. And that right there was a game changer.
No question.
Complete game changer.
Well, my story is exactly like yours. Really. I mean, it's very similar. As far as like, it's very hard to understand this for a believer. It's very hard to understand this for anybody. But it's literally what the podcast, what our company is named after, is Philippians 3:10, for our determined purpose is to come to know the King, share in his sufferings, in order to be transformed into his likeness. Okay? So that transformation does not happen the day you say, Lord, I'm yours.
Mm-hmm.
The transformation comes through suffering with him and for him. So the way we look at it, like I'm 6 weeks sober. What's today? Is today Monday? No, it's Tuesday. Yesterday. Okay.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Just like you, this was a reckoning. This was a freaking bunker buster sent into something that I have been clinging to for 15, 20 years, right? And God, through pain, destroyed it. I mean, literally, just crippled me. I mean, just absolutely was like, we're done here. We're done. Mm-hmm. And let me show you why. And I talk about how I got to that point in a couple of episodes that'll be coming out before this one. But the fact of the matter remains is that we feel like, and the church tells you, right, hey, love Jesus and you'll change. Not quite that simple. Very easy to say, very difficult to do. And the fact is that this is a journey. It's no different than becoming a man. It's an initiation into manhood. It's an initiation into being Christ-like. This is something that takes a long time. And what happens is believers get in this and they're like, why am I not changing? Why am I not changing? Why am I not changing? Well, you're not there yet. It's not there yet, you know? And understanding true dependence is something that requires weakness. And what makes you weak is pain and suffering mm-hmm. with the Lord. Now, whether that suffering looks like this sin is making me feel guilty and terrible, right? Or like quite literally having a disease. Like these things vary from person to person, depending on what phase they're in, whether it's air, hair, skin, bone, right? So mm-hmm. it's one of those deals where 6 weeks ago, I literally was like, Lord, please destroy my flesh. Like, let's kill it. Let's kill it dead. What you hate, I want to hate. Like, let's go. And do not pray that prayer without being prepared mentally. Because when the king goes to killing your flesh, that is you. You were born in that flesh. And it's in there, deep and bad. And it's no different than you were talking about the stuff from your childhood. Like, that's the flesh. That's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And when I prayed that prayer, there's a kid that worked for me. And he's young. He's not a believer. And I started fasting. Like, I just quit eating. Just drinking water, reading my Bible, and praying. And he was like, man, what's wrong with you, you know? And I was going through some stuff. And I told him, I said, there's a lot of things in me that need to go, that need to get taken care of. And there's an old guy that lives in here that needs to die. And he was like, he didn't even know what that meant. You know what I mean? He's looking at me like, what is going on? You know? And I just told him, I said, I'm going to starve him to death. I am going to fast until he is dead. And I did. And God, it's the first time in my life God's ever spoke to me. Like those moments where you're talking about God tapping you on the shoulder, I'd never experienced that until the third day of that fast. And I was in the bed and I was praying and trying to go to sleep and I couldn't sleep. And I don't know how long I'd laid there. It was probably 15 minutes, but it felt like 5 hours. You know what I mean? And God, it was like he stuck his hand on my head and was like, you are okay.
Mm-hmm.
And right after that, I woke up the next morning. I was like, okay. And I've been a completely different human. And people will say, you know, guys who they'll talk about struggling, quitting drinking, struggling, quitting porn, struggling, quitting insert sin here, whatever. And they're like, they struggle with it every day. And I'm gonna say that my theory, and this is just a theory because I've only experienced this twice in my life. The first time was with porn. Porn is just a nasty thing. And it makes you feel like shit, like guilty, like especially after you're married and you have sons and daughters and you're like, this is somebody's kid on here. Like, what the heck am I doing? And so my prayer there was, God, make the things that make me feel guilty. I don't want to feel guilty. Like, if it makes me feel guilty, make me hate it, you know? And it was like, that's not a problem. That was the prayer I needed to pray, the question I needed to ask. That was the door that I knocked, and he opened it. But drinking didn't make me feel guilty. Because like you said, everybody around me drank. Everybody. And I didn't get like sloppy drunk and slap my kids around and freaking not get up and go to work. I mean, I was a functioning alcoholic and was really good at it, honestly. I could drink a 12 pack and get up the next morning at 5, no problems, and go to work. And so the prayer there was totally different. It was like, if it is not profitable for me, if it is not good for me, destroy it. Like, come inside of me and annihilate that part of me. And he just did it. I have not thought about drinking. We go to a nice restaurant and there's the bar and it's not a bar. I'm just like, it's not profitable. I'll have a Diet Coke, please. You know, it's crazy. It's really nuts. And I think people will sit down and they'll pray a prayer and they're like, Lord, help me here. And then they walk off from it and they just expect God to do it. But destroying an enemy stronghold is not a, this is not a gentle thing. This is not a kind, soft part of the Father.
This is talking violence of action here.
This is bone, baby. Like, we're freaking getting after it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, man. That's the only way I can think of it. Cause I struggle with it forever, but I didn't want to quit. I wasn't asking God to help me quit drinking. I was just like, well, I'm going to quit drinking. And then dinner time comes and I'm like, yeah, beer sounds nice. You know, like, I don't know, man.
My deal was, there was a bunch of times where I quit. And then, I tell myself that I got it under control, but it all started small, you know. Okay, I'll have a beer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that one day. But then the next time, you know, I might have two beers.
Yep.
And it would just progress until the next thing you know, I'm back to, you know, a 12-pack or so. And I knew when I really started thinking about it, I knew that it was an issue when I was hiding it from my wife.
Ooh.
You know, I had beer in the outside fridge.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was always finding an excuse to go to the garage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then when, you know, it on the back end of things, when I really got to thinking about it, I'm like, well, why am I hiding it?
Yeah.
Because you're ashamed. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why are you ashamed? Probably because you got a problem. You know yep. what I mean? So
yeah,
it was rough, man. It was rough, but I'm right there with you now.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy, dude. I mean, it really is unbelievable to me. And during that fast, man, I was listening to the Gospels on audiobook and I was working and just pouring it in, baby. Come on. And it got to that part in Matthew where it talks about knock and the door will open, ask and you shall receive. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I've had, you know, I definitely believe in miracles. Both of my children are miracles, not just because they were born, and but Wiley and Kara almost died. Most certainly. If they wouldn't have been sitting in a hospital bed, they'd have both died. And then mm-hmm. Waylon was never supposed to even be here. Like, they told us we were going to have a surgical abortion, like literally sitting in the room to get an abortion.
Dude.
And luckily we had a really good doctor in Wyoming that we had just kind of, they told her it was ectopic and there's nothing you can do about it. You got to get rid of it. And it, anyway, God prevailed in all of that. And there's a lot of healing in the second one that happened. But when it comes to my arthritis, like, I am not a crippled person, but I could most certainly act like a crippled person if I wanted to. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like I literally, I was thinking about it last night. I was like, I should make a TikTok about this. But I sleep with my feet hanging off the bed and out of the covers because the blanket hurts my feet.
Daggum.
Yeah, it's obnoxious. It's like, damn, this is, I didn't even really realize I was doing it until last night. I was laying there. I was like, man, I wonder why I sleep like this every night. And I pulled my feet back and I was like, well, cause that fucking hurts. That's why, you know? And so.
What's that from, if you don't mind me asking?
It's hey, go play, bud. We'll play when I get done. It's from, I have psoriatic arthritis. It's an autoimmune disease. Yep.
I got you.
Cold water here. You can put cold water in there. That's fine.
What about some ice?
No ice. Just normal tap water will do fine. So, yeah, I got diagnosed about 7 years ago now. Well, 6 years ago. It was right after Wiley came. And, yeah, it's arthritis of the small joints. So it's hands, lower back, feet, neck. And it flares and goes away and comes back. But I've been praying a lot about it because I've basically just accepted the fact that I'm just going to live crippled. Like, the doctor told me when I got diagnosed, he was like, if you don't take care of yourself, you're going to be absolutely immobile by the time you're 50. And the, did your phone overheat?
Yeah.
You still there? Yeah, you're back. So he tells me I'm going to be crippled by the time I'm 50. And I was like, okay, well, that's no good. So I started hitting the gym real hard back then, because basically all of the symptoms of this deal got worse if you got fat, pretty much. Mm. And so I just decided then that, like, the only way out of this was through, and that I'm going to go to the gym no matter how bad it hurts and just push. And this is my cross to carry, and I'll carry it like a damn man. And And so, but recently with the drinking thing, and kind of the with the fasting and like God really delivering me through this time in life where like I didn't even know these kinds of things were possible. Like he's never really talked to me. He's never really, I always, you know, had a lot of faith and trusted and he's there, you know, but since that, my mindset towards the disease has changed a little bit. I'm like, okay, if I truly believe in the King of Kings, in the Lord of Lords, and he is all powerful and he is good, and what he has for me is good. And the Bible, Jesus literally says, knock and the door will open, ask and you shall receive. I started looking at my prayers a little different, where I'm like, all right, Lord, like, how am I supposed to carry this disease? Because the way I've been doing it really sucks, man. Like, this is terrible. So what do you want with this? You know what I mean? Hey, man, I need you to go play, please, right now. Thank you so much. So that's changed a lot of the ways that I've been talking with him about this. And I've always been really candid with the Father. Like, I talk to him the same way I talk on this podcast, you know, like if a what the moment happens in my life, I'm literally like, what the man, what do you want me to do with this? And so my own father in real life is a friend. My grandfather was a friend. And while they can discipline and counsel me in ways that other men cannot because of who they are and the respect I have for them, I offer even more so honor to the King, in the same way. But I speak to him like, I don't understand what's going on. So like, what's up? You know, like, I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't do that, but I don't know. He's I think he's up there laughing at me like most of the time. He's like, yeah, man, like sucks down there. You know, yeah, I know, you know, he lived here, so he knows, but we'll see. Maybe he'll heal my arthritis. Maybe he won't. And that's okay too. But I'm going to keep asking. I'll tell you that. I'm going to keep knocking on that door.
Dude, that has been, people are always talking about all the miracles and all the things that, you know, God does and saves. And, we was sitting at church listening to a sermon one time, but the pastor was, the message was, what if God doesn't? And I was like, oh, what if he doesn't?
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And that right there was so impactful. So I really appreciate it because, like you said, what if he doesn't?
Yeah.
He's still sovereign.
Yes.
You know, he's still the King. I still love him. I still trust him the same.
Jesus begged him.
To the point of sweat and blood.
Jesus begged him, please do not make me do this. And I prayed that prayer about this podcast. Like, the enemy has been absolutely kicking my ass since I started doing this thing. It's really frustrating. Like, it's really annoying. And when I went through that deal, quitting drinking and all the stuff, I was in my shower on my knees. I was like, God, please let me quit the podcast. Please. Because if I'm being honest, I do not have the time. I own two businesses. We are wide open with everything. My wife owns a business. Like, I don't, but this is what he's asking me to do. He is asking me to sit in front of this computer and visit with people. And it's the same with the arthritis. It's like, God, if it's your will that I walk around like this, let it be, you know? And I hold a lot of, I hang my hat on being able to suffer well. Like, that's important to me, is suffering at a high level and being good at it, because Jesus did. And that's the goal, is to be able to be miserable and just trust in him that the misery is worth it. The transformation is worth it. The kingdom is worth it. And I don't think that is a position that a lot of people take, but it's an honorable one for me. Might not be for everybody, but like, we name the damn company after a verse that literally says your purpose is to suffer. So mm-hmm. What are you supposed to do? You know what I mean? Like, that's why we're here. So it's good. The suffering is what shows God's strength. The suffering is what changes you deeply. And so if you have a purpose for suffering, if you have a reason to suffer, well, then it's way easier to suffer well, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a couple, I think it was Peter and John, that they were like over the moon excited that they were getting beat for being Christians and followers of Christ. You know, to them, it was a I don't remember the story exactly, but they were praising the Lord that they were getting beat.
Yeah.
Because they equated that to being Christ-like, because that's what Christ went through. And I've read that and I was like, oh man.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that changes perspective a little bit.
Oh man. It's those guys were freaking units, man. Like savages. And that was a prayer that a couple of weeks ago, I've been kicking around the idea of writing all this stuff down, and all the things I learned from the podcast, all the things I've learned from my own life, and just compile it into a book of like, and I was thinking of names, and I was thinking of names of chapters, and like kind of going through my life lessons in my head, because the whole purpose behind this deal is to share it so people can learn from it. And the phrase, the King Savage, kept coming up in my head. And like, you know, a savage in and of itself is a, I read the definition in the last episode, but it's something that is, oh man, I have to look it up. I can't think of the word. The word I'm looking for.
Did you put yourself on the spot?
Yes. A lack of civilization, brutality, or wildness, right? Not domesticated. That was the word I was looking for. And like, if you look at the disciples, if you look at those guys that he chose and the life that they led after he rose from the dead, they were freaking savages. Like, mm-hmm. It was such a contrast between them and what they were building and what the world is. Mm-hmm. And so that is in like, you know, cowboys and Indians, and they called the Indians savages. And for what they believed, right? And the way that they protected what was theirs, that's a good word. That's what I mean, like the ferocity in which they protected their kingdom, right? Is the same way that we should protect our kingdom, our children, our wives. And like, you know, you can use the word warrior. Everybody uses the word warrior. You know what I mean? But that's what a savage is.
Yep.
It's just a freaking warrior, dude. And I can't think, you watch old cowboy movies, dude. I can't think. Like, you send me into the worst part of downtown anywhere in Alabama where all the gangbangers live and the freaking projects, and I would be more confident walking into that than getting caught in a ravine with the Indians chasing me back in the day. You know what I'm saying? Like the way those guys were like, this is mine and you're not taking it from me, you know?
Yeah.
And I truly believe it's because there was some, and I don't know, I might be completely wrong. You can probably speak to this, but there was some connection to God that those guys had back then, solely based on the fact that they lived in what he created for them. Whether it's spiritual or whatever, but like the way they looked at the earth and the things that God provided for them, whether they knew it was Jesus or God or not, is kind of how I feel when I'm horseback and I'm in the middle of nowhere. I'm like, look at what he has made. And these dudes are sitting there, and they know how to live off of that. And then some dink comes in and starts tearing the place up, and they're like, "No, this ain't gonna work." You know what I mean? You gonna come in here and do all that? So I think, you know, as far as book names go, I was sitting there and I talk about Death Roads a lot. So like our drinking, right? The things that we choose to do that even the world says is a good thing, that just takes us away from our family, our kids, our wives. I call them death roads. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those death roads are dressed up like life roads. It's like, hey, I'm going to have a good career. I'm going to make a lot of money. And everybody in the world's like, hey, man, you make a lot of money. You know, you're doing really good for yourself. But there's no life in it. No life. You're just trading your time for money, and your kids are out here acting like a bunch of hooligans because they don't got a daddy around. Mm-hmm. And that's what pretty much every path I've run down, that some of my biggest lessons were all death roads. And so that's what I think I'm going to name the book, is The Art of Suffering, Death Roads. Like, here's all the things I did that I should not have done that might even look good. Like, that from a worldly perspective, everybody would want to do those things. But I was choosing me. Don't do that.
Don't do those.
No.
You should, man. It's you know, like I told you in the email, you never know what the impact you're going to make, you know? And it's, the world definitely needs more of that. Mm-hmm. It's, especially for guys that are out there, you know, everybody, you gotta really find what you connect with in order to be able to make any kind of progress, it seems like, you know. And I guess it's just all the delivery system, you know. It's like when I was trying to learn how to weld and fit pipe, all the math that I learned in school made absolutely no sense. But when I could see it on a piece of pipe or a piece of paper, mm-hmm. then I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so when you got somebody or something that people can actually, that makes sense, it connects, it makes it that much easier, you know, when you get a message in a way that is going to really resonate. Mm-hmm. So keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. And it's guys like you that come on and share, right? So like, that's the point. That's the point of the thing, is you're a guy that can sit and look at your life and go, damn it, I wish somebody would have told me.
Oh, man.
God, I just wish somebody would have said, hey, you stupid mother, what are you doing? Yeah. You know, like, God, dang it, man. And I had a conversation with my team yesterday at the rope shop. Like, I hired a bunch of new people, and we had kind of an orientation deal. And I told them, at the end of the orientation, I had a section that's called My Promise to You. Mm. And I promised them that I was going to fail, and that I was not going to live up to everything I wrote on that sheet of paper, and that I was not going to have the best ideas, and that I would do my best to be fair and honest and to apologize when I'm wrong. And then I told them, I said, I promise you, I will prioritize my family over this place. And I promise you that I'm going to hold you to the same standard. Mm. If you come in here and you tell me that you got to be at work to make ends meet, but you're missing a kindergarten graduation, I'm going to tell you to leave. Mm-hmm. Because you're picking the wrong thing. And I'm going to pay you anyway. Mm. Just go. Because that's the thing, man, is that everybody's looking at it from a profit and loss standpoint. Of like, we got a business to run, yada, yada. We're here making fruit, dude. We're making people. And those people, by nature, are going to have to work hard. If they come in that shop with me, and I will outrun every damn one of them. Because leading from the front is the only way to get anybody to follow. But the fact is that if I have a choice between my wife and that rope shop, I promise you I'm going to pick my wife. Every time. Mm-hmm. Every time. And if we hold that standard to one another, and see, that's the thing, man, is like, a guy will sit there with you and watch you choose the wrong thing, even though he knows, and won't say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
He won't say nothing to you. He'll just go, man, you're kind of working a lot, man. Instead of just saying, when's the last time you kissed your freaking wife, buddy? You know what I mean?
Yep.
And when's the last time you went home and just played with your kids? And then not, it's not a rhetorical question. Answer the question. When's the last time you went home and played with your kids? And then look at the guy like, and when he says, man, I can't remember, go home and do it, Bill. What? Like, what even matters out here, you know? And
right.
Those kinds of conversations with men are the ones that I wish somebody would have said to me. Like, and that's why I have them on the podcast. It's like, if the 150 people that listen to this episode, the 2,000 people, however many people listen to it, if five of those guys are like, I'm going to go home and play with my youngins. Well, then it's a freaking home run, baby. We did it.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
But they're hard to have conversations.
That's why community is so important, man. And it's, I've always been just by nature a very kind of stoic person. You know, I don't really get close with folks real easy.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have, if you know, it's important to be able to make a connection with people to be able to do that. You know, so you can say, hey, man, you sure about that?
Yeah. Right. Yes.
You know, that's it's a valuable commodity, and especially in this day and age,
for sure. It's hard to find, but that's the goal, is to build it. And that's what you're doing today, sharing your story. That is what you're doing. Whether you know it or not, whether you're just like, oh, it's a cool podcast, and he's taking guests or whatever. But what the king does with it is just you being willing to sit here and go, man, I fucked up plenty.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. And that's what's crazy, dude, is that's all it takes. Is like somebody who's willing and humble enough to go, God, I am nothing. And the fact that you've done anything with me is unbelievable. Like, blast God's strength in a way that it's recognized, it's relatable to people. They're like, oh, mm-hmm. Man, I suck too. Yeah, we all do, man. Like, just because your daddy was a Baptist and he pretended to be perfect, don't mean he was.
Yeah.
Just because your granddaddy was a preacher and he was perfect and everybody came to you and like, he loves the Lord and he blah, 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 and you didn't feel like you could live up to it, doesn't mean he was.
Yep.
And it's a failure in manhood. It's a failure in the initiation process to fool your children and their children into thinking that you are.
Mm-hmm.
You failed. It's okay. I love you anyway. God showed it to me, I guess. I don't know. But if I live my life right here and go, man, these are the roadblocks I hit. These are the mountains I jumped off of. These are the bones I broke. And I hope you don't have to. If you do, I'm gonna love you anyway. But I don't know. Hopefully you can at least skip a few of them if I share them. And that's what I hope for my sons. That's what I hope. I hope there's, I can surround myself with other men like me. They can learn from me. They can learn from them. And then by the time they're my age, they're like, they're wise. That's the goal.
That's the goal.
That's the goal.
Save somebody some of the pain I went through.
Exactly. Exactly. So, Gabe, man, thank you so much for coming on, man. It was a great conversation. I'm going to hang on.
My pleasure.
Let me save your I'm going to save your number real quick. Man, are you getting like 5 billion spam calls a day? Like, it's out of hand. Well, these people need a job. It's freaking nuts.
Not so much anymore.
Gosh, they're blowing me up. Gabe Castro. Sweet. All right, brother. Well, I'm going to go tie some ropes, man.
Don't forget you got to go fishing.
That's right. Yes, that's an afternoon project. It's like 100 freaking degrees here. They ain't biting right now.
Yeah, I'm sure it's 100 degrees and probably 99% humidity, huh?
Yep. We're going to have to swim to the car as soon as we open that back door. Yeah, dude. Okay.
Good luck.
Yes, thank you so much, man. Well, thanks for coming on, brother. Stay in touch, dude. Keep me posted, and we'll do it again sometime.
All right, Pard. Thank you.
All right. Take it easy, buddy.